The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, September 6th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday after Labor Day. For President Barack Obama, it's a continuation of the labor that has characterized these waning months of his presidency, confronting the U.S. war legacy in the Pacific. A 3-day visit to the tiny communist Southeast Asian nation of Laos has begun. The president flew to the capital of Vientiane, where he met with the new president, Bonhang Varachi. Improving U.S.-Laos relations is important for an overall strategy of strengthening the so-called ASEAN nations. That's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations that was formed during the Cold War. But it may be more significant today in facing China's growing dominance in the region. The Vietnam War had consequences for Laos, which was the victim of secret U.S. bombing during the Nixon presidency, when the U.S. dropped an estimated 2 million tons of bombs, all told. The president pledged more money to clean up unexploded munitions in Laos that maim approximately 10,000 Laotians each year. There are also human rights concerns with this government in Laos, including concerns about the human rights abuses of people critical of the one-party communist state, including the disappearance of Sombat Sampan, an internationally acclaimed worker and activist who's been missing since 2012. Phil Robertson is deputy director of the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. He joins us from Bangkok to remind us that this president is finishing up a long-standing policy shift from the Cold War era.
This is a continuation of his pivot to Asia, but obviously, we hope that he will engage with the government, that he will clean up the cluster munitions that were dropped by the United States on Laos during the Vietnam War. But we also want him to raise human rights and set a tone that Laos should care about its people and not just about economic growth and good relations with other neighboring governments.
Of course, from the Laotian perspective, cluster bombs are about human rights as well.
Yeah, and we agree. We strongly support the initiative by the administration to really put its money where its mouth is and really try to make a significant dent in cleaning up this huge UXO contamination that exists in Laos. I mean, this is one of the most heavily impacted countries in the world, and the United States bears direct responsibility for that.
Does a significant initiative on the question of munitions give the U.S. more influence on human rights politically inside of Laos?
Probably not, actually, because I think the Lao government views these things as separate. The Lao government views the issue of cleaning up the munitions as an ongoing responsibility of the United States and to be done in partnership. The disappearance of the most prominent rural development practitioner, a guy named Sombat Sampan, 3 years ago at a police checkpoint, still remains unresolved. This guy was someone who was a community organizer who graduated from the University of Hawaii and won one of the most prestigious awards in Southeast Asia, the Magsaysay Award. So, you know, for them to disappear someone like that really raises some fundamental issues about human rights and rule of law in Laos.
Is there any information about his whereabouts or whether he's alive or dead?
There's none. What we know is that he was taken at a police checkpoint at a major road in the capital. It was caught on CCTV. The family has the videotape, which was actually a police videotape, but the police have refused to allow anybody else to have access to that tape after the family was able to take a copy of it with us.
Given the rise of China in the region, where does Laos stand and how worried is it about China, or how much of an ally is it with China in dealing with issues involving political instability, say, for instance, in the South China Sea?
The closest relationship that Laos has had, and almost a big brother, younger brother relationship, has been with Vietnam. And if you look at the structures of the government and the priority that the government gives, you know, really, Vietnam has been some back and forth between ruling elites in Laos and whether they favor China and Vietnam. But most analysis believe this has really been resolved in the favor of the Vietnamese. That said, I don't think Laos gains a lot by getting heavily involved in the South China Sea kerfluffle between China and other members of ASEAN.
As far as Vietnam is concerned, the U.S. has a significant influence in Vietnam. How do you think that stands at this point, and does that have leverage in terms of human rights in Laos?
I think the United States' influence in Vietnam, I mean, we've urged President Obama during previous visits to Vietnam to raise human rights issues, and he proved to be remarkably resistant to doing so. President Obama has continually failed to really take up human rights issues on these Asian trips in a systematic way.
Speaking to us from Bangkok, Phil Robertson is Deputy Director of the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. Thanks so much, Phil.
Thank you.
So it's your last trip to Asia, and the Philippine president curses you out. So you have to cancel a planned meeting with one of the U.S.'s oldest allies and former colony. Or you fly all the way to Hangzhou, China for your last G20 summit, and as you roll to a stop, airport crews won't roll up the special red-carpeted head of state stairway so you can walk off the plane. Oh, the pitfalls of being a president. Of course, Air Force One is fully prepared for this kind of diplomatic slap in the face, and so the crew deployed its smaller, less stately fold-up staircase stored in the hull of the airplane. President would later not make much of the Chinese incident himself, but it was a humble start to joining the international leaders at the G20 summit, his 10th and final in Hangzhou, China this weekend. The biggest development here was the reaffirmation of the mutual renewed promises to cut greenhouse gases. But China really sees this moment in American history to be an opportunity for Beijing to increase its standing in the world. Roger Baker is the Vice President of Strategic Analysis for Stratfor. He joins me now. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you.
Is this a positive farewell to the G20 for President Obama, or something of a good riddance from China?
Well, I think that on the one hand, Obama will certainly be able to play up the idea of the environmental agreements with China as being something very positive for his presidency. But certainly the Chinese did make it a point that China is very important and that the United States' role in the global economy and as the central global figure may be waning, or at least that's how the Chinese want to portray it.
And is this tied in with the election? I mean, do the Chinese see that the end of the Obama era is the beginning of some period of instability and uncertainty as far as the U.S. role in the world is concerned?
I think there is a concern along those lines, not only in China, but in other places. That said, there really is a perception overall that as China increases in its economic activity and its international relations and its international position, as other countries continue to do so as well, that just by default, the United States takes a slightly smaller role than it had in the past.
What does the U.S. Do about North Korea? Its influence there depends very much on a cooperative arrangement with China. Where do you see that at this point?
The Chinese really have not been as cooperative as the United States would like, or at least not in the way in which the United States would like. The North Koreans made a great show of launching several Nodong missiles during the G20 summit to draw attention to themselves and perhaps to emphasize the disagreements between the United States and China in that level of cooperation, to exacerbate some of the disagreements between China and the South Koreans over the deployment of THAAD. So, yes, there does need to be cooperation. What the United States would like from China is much more assertive action toward North Korea. The Chinese are very concerned about that because, in the end, they would really not like to see a destabilized North Korea along their border.
Instead, though, it seems that China is very much focused on the South China Sea and using encroachment in the South China Sea as a way of riling up Indochina, and particularly concerning Japan, where there was a meeting between President Xi and President Abe at this G20 meeting. What did they discuss?
So the Chinese and the Japanese discussed both the South China Sea, where the Chinese told Japan in no uncertain terms that they were not welcome in the South China Sea. But they also talked about easing some of the tensions in the East China Sea, establishing hotline mechanisms to be able to manage potential confrontations and potentially restarting some joint development in the area.
Would you say that that's a sign that China wants to work with Japan, or that there's more of a strategic attempt to possibly move Japan away from the United States?
It's a combination of both. The Chinese do want to work a little bit more closely with Japan. They don't want to have direct confrontation within the region with larger powers such as Japan, such as South Korea. At the same time, by offering incentives for cooperation, by offering potential economic relations to grow and to increase, they're hoping that that does get Japan looking more at the bilateral relationship with China rather than looking at itself as a ally partner with the United States and looking at the U.S. agenda in the region.
With all of the rhetoric in the presidential campaign against the TPP agreement, I would suspect that President Obama couldn't even bring up the subject with a straight face as far as the other leaders are concerned. They have no assurance that the U.S. is going to endorse and ratify this agreement.
Certainly with the TPP, this has been a very difficult meeting for Obama. He's tried to reassure everyone that he will be able to push for TPP after the U.S. election and before the U.S. inauguration. The Japanese have been talking about moving forward with their ratification, but it is looking less and less likely, at least in the near term, that TPP has a strong chance. And that changes a lot of the expectations in the region, particularly with countries like Vietnam that were making adjustments based on the idea of what they were going to gain from TPP.
So all in all, and you mentioned it at the beginning of our conversation, if we were to give a sense of the legacy of President Barack Obama with the G20, and particularly in terms of the rising economy of China, it would have to be the climate change agreements that we're going to remember 10, 20 years from now.
That would seem to be the biggest success for Obama in this forum.
And do you think they're going to be very much the beginning of something that's going to continue for the next 10 or 20 years, or will we see a reversal?
Well, we've seen climate change be a very difficult type of problem for countries to actually implement on a unified scale. There are some aspects that are going to go forward here, but certainly there's a lot of room for slow progress or even reversal along some trend lines.
All right. Roger Baker is the Vice President of Strategic Analysis for Stratfor. He spoke to us from Austin, Texas. Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
We're always trying to assess the value of a college education with those expensive tuition bills. Is the ranking of an institution important? Does it tell you anything? How does your college rank?
My name's Jack from California. My college was not ranked. All my career moves, including a recent one to a Big Four consulting firm, have been facilitated by networking and work experience, not college notoriety.
Hi, this is Todd from Eugene, Oregon, and I went to the number two school in the world, actually, Berklee College of Music in Boston, and that's totally why I went there. It absolutely has made a difference in my personally and personally in my life.
But a very different experience from New York, New York. My school was ranked number one in the country for my major, opera, and I decided that if I got in, I'd go solely because of that. Worst decision I ever made, point blank, flat out, no hyperbole, no exaggeration. I regretted it every day for 20 years. More of that story. Love to hear it. And call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Comment at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
The New York Times profiled Dearborn County, Indiana last week, noting that this community was moving opposite to a national trend of finding alternatives to incarceration for nonviolent drug offenders. In fact, this county in the southern part of Indiana does not have a high rate of violent crime. Its population living below the poverty line is below average for the state and nation. And yet, Dearborn County has one of the highest incarceration rates in the United States. About 1 in 10 adults in the county find themselves in prison, jail, or probation. Dearborn County Defense Attorney Doug Garner says the situation makes it difficult to address serious social problems in the community.
You wonder why people reoffend. Well, you know, you put them in jail for 2 years and you send them out at 22 with a felony conviction. They don't have, they're not getting rehabilitation in jail. They're not getting training in jail. They're getting out 22 years old with a felony conviction. You know, yeah, they're probably going to reoffend at that point. And so, you know, we're spending $30,000 or $40,000 a year per inmate put them in jail, and a fraction of that money could be spent on, you know, rehabilitation, drug treatment, with a better outcome.
This aggressive prosecution rate is the policy of County Prosecutor Aaron Negengarten. He joins us now. Aaron, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me on the show.
What's going on in this region that causes this high rate of both crime and incarceration?
Well, I think our close proximity to Cincinnati causes a lot of a crime that runs over from the Cincinnati area into our jurisdiction. But I think also it's a reflection of the hard work that is done by law enforcement, the judges, the probation department, the community corrections department, and our office.
But would you describe it as a success to have that number of individuals in prison, jail, or on probation?
I would describe that if you look at incarceration rates, that's just one aspect of the story. What the story didn't tell was the number of alternatives to incarceration that we offer. For example, really only 1 in 10 people who are arrested and charged in Dearborn County are sent to prison, and it's actually less than that, but that's approximate. So there are a number of evidence-based programs that we have in place that weren't noted in the story.
But nevertheless, that is one of the highest rates of incarceration in the country.
Well, per capita, it's a high rate of incarceration, but that just means we're holding people accountable. Given the number of programs that we offer for alternatives to incarceration, I think it does spell the fact that we are working very hard in Dearborn County to hold people accountable to the law.
And would you say that policies elsewhere are not holding people accountable?
I would say that policies apparently in San Francisco and Cincinnati are not holding people accountable.
Let me play you something that was said by someone who I think that you know, a Dearborn County defense attorney, Doug Garner, who talked about the limitations and inadequate alternatives in Dearborn County and Ohio County.
You know, normally in a bigger city, I think you would be able to find drug treatment that doesn't immediately feed them into the correctional system. But what happens here is that either the school or the hospital ends up calling law enforcement to deal with it. And so all these people immediately are tagged as in the criminal system. And it's not long, if you've got a drug problem, that you end up with a felony conviction. And then at 18 or 19, if you have a felony conviction, it's very difficult to move forward at that point.
Would you agree that people are being tagged with felonies at the early part of their lives, and therefore that limits their ability to do anything subsequently?
No, I disagree with that, and that's in fact not accurate. I mean, in Indiana, there's often many opportunities to avoid getting a felony conviction. First and foremost, we have a diversion program, and we've recently expanded the diversion program with the revision of the criminal code. For example, we now allow felonies to be diverted given if they get assessed, participate in evidence-based programs such as online programs and a classroom. They have to also complete counseling as directed based on their assessment. I would say that that's an opportunity to avoid a conviction altogether. Now, some people don't want to work that hard, and so they end up with a felony conviction. The drug court that's been in place for a number of years has also been available and has been successful. And I would also note that that allows people to avoid a felony conviction. Also note that people on felony convictions can frequently find work in the area. In fact, I know some people who have been convicted of felony convictions making more money than myself. So I would disagree with that characterization that these people have no other alternative. What is unfortunate is for most people to come to the point where they're ready to seek rehabilitation, they need to be looking at a significant penalty in jail.
At a moment when the federal government and other states and localities are moving away from incarcerating nonviolent offenders, drug offenders, to have the rate of incarceration that you have seems that you're very much moving in the other direction. Would you agree that that's the case?
I would agree that the country, parts of the country, are probably headed in the wrong direction on this issue. But I would disagree that these are nonviolent offenders that are going to prison. I disagree with that assessment. Who is being sent to prison are people who pose a threat to public safety. Some of those people happen to be drug addicts, some of them aren't, but they still pose a threat to public safety.
And even if they haven't been convicted of a violent offense, like assault or armed robbery or something.
An unrehabilitated drug addict is dangerous. First off, they're stealing. They're stealing from either elderly people or they're exploiting their own parents and grandparents. They're stealing from the community. They're forging checks wherever they can find a way to get money. They're burglarizing houses. They're operating while impaired. Furthermore, if they have children, I haven't met an unrehabilitated drug addict yet who wasn't neglecting their children in some manner or another. These are issues that have to be addressed. They cannot just operate with impunity without a consequence when they're posing a risk to the public safety of the citizens of our jurisdiction.
Aaron Negengard is a prosecutor for Dearborn County. He spoke to us from Cincinnati, Ohio. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
And now we spend a few minutes with an outstanding student heading back to classes, like a lot of people this fall. Istel Amakali Tejeda is a U.S. citizen, but she lives in violent Juarez, Mexico. Went to school there through high school. Each day she crosses the border to attend classes at El Paso Community College. She did so well, she became a Jack Kent Cook Foundation scholar. And her next educational journey is at the University of Texas in El Paso, a four-year institution, a real college, she calls it. Istel credits her mentors at El Paso Community College who helped her learn English and succeed.
I think I have a couple of mentors that were my life mentors. One of them was my English professor, even though he was an American, like blue eyes, blonde hair, like American. He read my essays and he could really relate to all my struggle and he would really accommodate me. He would help me with my essays since English was not my first language. He actually really helped me being fluent. He gave me a job in the English department where nobody spoke Spanish. And then I have my other mentor. She was my chemistry professor. So she's the one that actually helped me develop my research. She actually relates a lot to me since she was also from Mexico and she did her studies in the same high school that I did.
Your teacher gave you a job in an office where everyone spoke English except for you. And that was a favor?
I think it was.
Like, how did it work out? I mean, how did you even manage to function?
So I actually had to force myself to speak English more fluently every day. And I just started speaking it like little by little until I actually became friends with all of these different English professors.
They're confident enough in you and you're confident enough in yourself to enter the biophysics contest, give presentations in English, and enter yourself in awards with other English as a first language candidates?
It was mandatory in the program that I was in. I knew I wanted to do research, which is very cool. You're just like in the lab, you're working on your own stuff. But at some point you have to explain what you're doing. You have to, because there's no point in doing research if you're not sharing it with the scientific community. And I actually got an award. It was the first place for all the research that I was doing.
How did you feel about that?
I was shocked. First of all, like all these English as a first language, they were competing against me. And not only that, but they were competing from four-year universities where they have all these advanced classes. And I was coming from a community college where there was not a lot of resources. What someone would consider as a disadvantage, which is my English language or all my background culture. Right now, I can use it as something that differentiates me from everybody else. So right now that I'm sharing my story with you, some people might relate to what I'm saying and they might get encouraged, like, okay, so maybe she's doing all of this. She was able to succeed. She was able to go and speak like in the radio in another language, and she's not doing that bad. So why can't I just start speaking more English? Or why can't I just approach my professor and ask him a question in English? It's just like the little decisions that we make throughout our life that really pulls us where we are right now.
Tell me a little bit about this scientific internship that you'll be doing in real research in microbiology.
I'm working in an antibiotic lab, and it's really good because, you know, like right now, all these crazy bacteria are getting resistant to different antibiotics. So in my lab, we're working to search for new antibiotics.
We've been doing stories about community colleges and people who are really awakened by the community college experience and go on to things way beyond what they ever imagined. And you're just such a fantastic example.
And just the fact of knowing that I can succeed as a student, even with all of these different disadvantages, it just made me realize that probably I am like a success.
You know, I think it's great, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much. And I really appreciate your time in doing this interview and just like being interested in my story. It really makes me feel special.
It's Itzel Amakali-Tejeda in classes this fall semester at the University of Texas in El Paso.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's easy to believe in the value of a four-year college degree if you start from such a place of few opportunities as young Itzel Amakali-Tejeda. But what about people paying the full tuition bill to send their kids to college? Is a credential at the end of the day worth that price of admission? Sean Gallagher is the author of The Future of University Credentials, New Developments at the Intersection of Higher Education and Hiring. He's the chief strategy officer at Northeastern University. He says the hallowed brands of some top-tier colleges are going to face reality checks in the future, and other institutions without such reputation brands are going to find themselves out in the cold.
For the most part, the constructs that we have today when we think about brand and reputation and prestige and outcomes for students, I think are fairly consistent with people's perception, but there's a tremendous amount of variety with these credentials. We talk about degrees and even colleges and universities like they're commodities, but you can major in so many different types of program. You can attend so many different types of institution. We have more than 4,000 degree-granting universities in the U.S. So until you dig in and study it and look at the data, even if you're an employer making a hiring decision, if you haven't studied how individuals that went to school X versus school Y perform, which is what they're beginning to do today in the era of big data, it's hard to really say what institution is better. You're starting to see more data on performance and people's career paths end up accessible and transparent. And the question is really, will that transparency begin to erode some of the shortcuts that we take when we think about what is quality or what does the brand behind a certain degree mean?
What is the challenge for a parent in trying to determine the importance of the reputation of a school and how it relates to the specific character of their child and then how much they want to pay? How different is that from the employer making a similar kind of decision?
I think they both have similar decisions. On the employer side, they have the benefit of seeing many different individuals who have come through their organization, perhaps, that have degrees from a given institution. And so there's a pattern there of performance, whereas with an individual, with a family, that's really one of maybe a handful of college enrollment decisions that they'll make. And in both cases, there's more data to turn to. There's more third parties and different types of evaluation. But certainly it's a very important choice.
Can consumers empower themselves with all of this data, or is it going to really be the emergence of some kind of authority figure that takes this data and turns it into something that consumers can use?
Right now, it's in the early stages. The federal government has launched a college scorecard in the last year or two, so that's an interesting effort. There's continually more and more higher education rankings arrangements and publications that are getting into that game. And then you can also look at the data on its own in terms of what people are earning and where they went to school, and through platforms like LinkedIn actually follow people's career paths. So there's no turning back that we're headed in a direction where there's much more information that's accessible and to consider. But given the fact that we're talking about an experience that people invest many years in typically, even if they're doing something short form, a credential, the degree that you earn becomes part of your identity. And so it's not like a quick consumer decision or even something big like a car or a home purchase. This is something that most people only do a few times in their life if they're at college to begin with.
Are institutions of higher learning able to disengage the brick-and-mortar experience of going to college for 4 years as an undergraduate? Just to use that example, you could also talk about master's and PhD programs as well. Disengage that brick-and-mortar experience from the just getting of the degree by various other means, so online, night school, various other ways of getting the same kinds of information. Are they doing that, or do people have to figure that out on their own?
That's where a great deal of the innovation is happening. And in the future, even with a traditional residential campus experience for an 18 or 19-year-old, you'll see much more online woven into it. But it's important to remember that there are aspects of the face-to-face experience and interaction, as we see in so many parts of our lives, where we can do things digitally, but there's a connectivity, and in many cases, people prefer to actually interact with individuals in real time, where that traditional experience will be changing, especially in terms of professional education and lifelong learning and advanced degrees. Online education has become much more accepted. If we look back 10 or 15 years, it was still seen as relatively new. One of the interesting statistics is of all the graduate education enrollment in the United States as we sit here today, one-third of it is delivered through online study. And so that's crept up a few percentage points each year to where it's now very much mainstream. And over the last year or two, especially, you've seen even the most elite and conservative institutions start to develop online offerings.
So how much of all of this, and thinking very generally now, allows us to better or perhaps not so much answer the question, is the amount I'm paying for tuition worth it? What would you advise?
In terms of tuition, I think there's more data on return on investment. Return on investment and that idea from being a consumer and out of business is really something that's driving the dialogue about higher education at all levels. And increasingly, I think we'll be able to see if I did a certain type of program from a certain type of institution, and this was my major, or this is what I focused on, here's what the likely outcomes could be for me, because we're able to look across the economy at how that kind of experience turned out for other people. It's really exciting that we have all this potential disruption and these technologies and new business models, many of them out of Silicon Valley and elsewhere, that can really change the game. But it's still very early in terms of how this is evolving.
Sean Gallagher is the author of The Future of University Credentials, and he's Chief Strategy Officer at Northeastern University. Thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Brandon calling from Garland. I think my college ranking was so-so, and that was not a part of what I went there for. It was a Christian university, and that's personally what made the difference for me.
This is Anthony from Cocoa, and no, I didn't look up my school because I'm poor, so I went to community college, and I have half the debt of everybody I work with.
Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, I don't know how it ranked nationally. It had the best agriculture program in the state, but it was the farthest I could go from home and still pay in-state tuition. Different ways of looking at colleges. Much more at thetakeaway.org. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Our hour-long look yesterday at how immigration and American labor history intersect was our way of noting America's Labor Day.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me.
And now a look at a man who lived and died at that intersection. We remember a legendary folk hero for the American worker, Joe Hill. He arrived in this country in 1902 as a poor, unknown Swedish immigrant. A decade later, he had become an icon and leader of the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies. The union sang songs written by Hill as a form of protest against low wages and poor working conditions. But fate took a turn for Hill, who was executed by firing squad for murder, a crime that some historians argue Hill was wrongly convicted of. Matthew Billy is the host of the podcast Between the Liner Notes, and he started a petition to exonerate Joe Hill over 100 years after his death.
You know, when he was executed, he became a mythological figure almost. You know, I mean, people sing songs about him, people write about him, and the saga still continues.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night.
Alive as you and me.
Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead.
I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
But does that mean we know who he actually was, aside from a martyr?
Yeah, we know quite a bit about him. We know a lot about his life in Sweden before he came over. You know, both his parents had died. Actually, they got sick because of the conditions that they were working in factories and the railroad over in Sweden. You know, so after his mother passed away, which was his last living parent, he decided to use the money from the sale of the house to buy passage over to New York City. And that was in 1902. And then for the next 5 years or so, we don't know that much about him. We know that he was in the San Francisco earthquake in 1905. Mm. We know that because he wrote a letter back to his home paper in Sweden about his experience in the earthquake. And then he pops up in 1907, 1908 in Portland, Oregon. And that's when he first registers for the industrial workers of the world and becomes a card-carrying member.
There is power in the band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand.
Where does the Wobblies come from?
Nobody actually knows that. There's a couple of speculations, which I really shouldn't say on radio because they're pretty bad. But the Wobblies was just a nickname for the IWW.
Right,
and so Joe Hill was a Wobbly or IWW from 1907 until his execution.
As a worker, was he, and as an activist, was he a skilled songwriter? Was he a leader?
In terms of leadership, he's not exactly hopping on the soapbox and giving speeches at street corners. He took more of a lower level role, but I think you would consider him a leader. Really, he led through his songwriting. He started writing songs for the IWW at a very pivotal point in their history. They were trying to strike against these employment agencies that were ripping off the workers. And employment agencies hired the Salvation Army Band to drown out the soapboxers. You know, it's hard for, no matter how strong your voice is, you can't beat a 20-piece horn orchestra. You're just not going to do it. So Joe Hill and a couple of other guys in Spokane decided to write new lyrics over the Salvation Army's hymn book melodies. And so when the Salvation Army Band struck up, they would just start singing. And it worked.
And you will eat, you will eat,
by and by,
by and by,
in that glorious land in the sky.
Yeah,
I work and pray,
work and pray,
live on hay,
live on hay.
And you'll get by in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
The Starvation Army, they play.
But why are his songs remembered and passed down from worker to worker and generation to generation, long before recorded music?
Couple of reasons. First of all, everyone already knew the melodies. So learning new lyrics on top of the melodies was easy. A lot of people at the time weren't very well educated, often didn't speak English very well. So, you know, it's much easier to get the information you need from a song rather than from a news article or some other periodical publication. The reason these things have been preserved and have been passed down is because the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, were so good at publishing and getting the songs out into the world. They had a publication called the Little Red Songbook, which every couple of months they would come out with a new edition with new songs addressing whatever the topics were that they were facing. And they would sell these things for a nickel or a dime, and they would get in the hands of merchant marines and travel all around the world. I mean, dock workers in Australia knew the songs that Joe Hill was writing on the west coast of America.
Joe Hill was executed for a crime he didn't commit. Describe the circumstances there.
It hasn't been 100% proven that he did commit this crime, but I think the evidence is pretty good that he didn't. What happened was this. John Morrison was a grocery store owner. On January 10th, 1914, him and his two children were closing up for the night, and two guys come in with red bandanas over their faces. They both have guns. They point the guns at John Morrison and say, "We've got you now," and then they fire. John Morrison's son reaches behind the counter and grabs the gun under there and allegedly shoots one of the culprits. And then one of the two men shoots his son. The second son hid in the back room, heard everything, but didn't see anything, even though he testified a little differently. What happens then is, this murder, front page news in all four newspapers in Salt Lake City, Utah. Joe Hill has the unfortunate experience of also receiving a gunshot wound on that exact same night, and he goes to a doctor. The doctor dresses the wound, doesn't think anything about it, until the governor of Utah says there is a $500 reward for anyone who has any information leading to the person or people who shot John Morrison. The doctor's like, "Oh, $500, that's a lot of money in 1914. So he turns Joe Hill in. He says, "Hey, I have this guy you might be interested in. He had a gunshot wound on the same night, and he's a member of the Industrial Workers of the World."
That was all it took.
Yes.
You want a pardon for Joe
Exonerate,
Hill.
Exonerate, yes.
Exonerate. And others have tried to do this as well.
Yes, there have been a couple of attempts. The AFL-CIO tried in 1979 on Joe Hill's 100th birthday. The governor said no. Another gentleman, Clayton Sims, who was a criminal lawyer in Utah, tried to do it last year on the 100th anniversary of his execution. The governor again said no. But this time, we're going to succeed. I would also like to point out that in Utah, one of the hot issues right now is the death penalty. There's a lot of Republicans in that state pushing to get rid of the death penalty. And they also still have the firing squad as a method of execution. If they run out of the lethal injection, I think issues like this are in the public zeitgeist right now. So I think a lot of people are going to be very excited about it.
Have you ever dreamed you saw Joe Hill?
I have not. I have not dreamed I saw Joe Hill.
Could happen.
You never know.
Matthew Billy is the host of the podcast Between the Liner Notes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, "But Joe, you're 10 years dead." "I never died," says he. "I never
died." And in a
died,
very different place in the annals of American labor history, here's something to take with you. In the dreary saga of Fox, the value of accepting the alleged sexual advances of former and fired Fox News chief Roger Ailes was possibly a secure job on cable news, but the value of saying no to him and going public, that's $20 million. The report of the settlement between Fox and Gretchen Carlson. Word is that this Ailes business is just beginning, as people with secure jobs at Fox don't want to be branded with being a part of Ailes' tawdry management style. Well, would you? That's all for this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.